Well, okay, so that makes this the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 31st of May, 2017. And our dutiful Secretary Craig will call the roll. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, the people that I have so far, myself, Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis, Frank Tolopko, Lynn Bradbury, Bill Wilt, Wayne Costi, Barton Bruce, and James Hufford. Is there anybody I didn't get?
Paul Zaremba.
Oh, Paul, hi.
Hi.
All right.
Ryan is also here.
Was it just Paul that was the one that I didn't list, or somebody else?
Yeah. Ryan Hess.
Ryan Hess, did I hear?
Yes, Ryan Hess.
Okay, great. And what was the other one, the other person?
Dan Hennen.
Dan Hennen. Okay, great.
Yep, thanks.
Bill, how do you wish to be listed in the minutes at the moment? I know we had you listed as congressional candidate before, but how do you want to be described?
Oh, that's fine. I run every 2 years, whether I win or not.
Well, we'll keep it there then. Great.
There perennial. You can list him as perennial congressional candidate, maybe. Yeah.
Sure. Good.
Sure.
That's right.
We also have a person with a wireless caller who it begins with 857. Anyone want to claim that number?
No.
857-276-0796. Nobody.
Must be from the NSA.
Well, let's see. Paul, wait a minute. I don't see your number up here, Paul.
It's on page 2.
Oh, it's on page 2. Okay. Yeah, okay.
It's not about my number.
So, did you get Wayne Costi, Craig?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, so why don't you run down the list again, and we'll see who that wireless caller is by elimination, okay?
Okay, Craig McKee, Ken Freeland, James Hufford, Barton Bruce, Wayne Costi, Ryan Hess, Cheryl Curtis, Frank Tolopko.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Frank Tolopko, Lynn Bradbury, Bill Wilt, Paul Zaremka, Dan Hennen.
So there is someone there.
Well, sir, whoever you are, if you don't identify yourself, we're going to have to drop you from the call. So please, if you haven't heard your name mentioned, let us know who you are. Otherwise, we're going to have to bid you adieu.
So again, the number starts with 857, area code 857. Is that anybody?
Right. Might remind them that *6, if they're muted, will unmute them, although they probably should know if they're already muted.
Why am I not? I'm looking at the page, Cheryl, and I'm not seeing that number
page,
at all.
Page
why am
two.
I not?
Go to page two.
Page two.
Well,
page two.
I was okay. I'm still not seeing it. I'm on page two.
Wireless caller and Paul.
Wireless Zimbabwe. Caller.
Yeah, it's not showing on my screen.
Well, you see it, right, Ken?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So it's
that's
a
weird.
Yes, that is.
Oh,
weird.
I'm looking below. Sorry, I was looking at active speakers below. Sorry. Yes, of course, you're right.
Okay, so a wireless speaker, a wireless caller, we're going to have to drop you, and then if you care to call back and let us know who you are, you're welcome to do so. Good night.
That's cute.
Okay.
Okay, so there we are, and now we're ready to begin our teleconference with a review of the minutes of the previous meeting as circulated by Craig on Friday. Any objections to approving the minutes or any amendments for the minutes? Hearing none, then we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to consideration of the draft agenda for this evening as circulated by me on Saturday. Any amendments to the draft minutes? Hearing none, then we shall drop the draft minutes for our proceedings this evening and move on to our first item, which is Frank. And here to introduce him is my co-facilitator, Karen. Cheryl. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I think most of you probably know Frank, but Frank has been into 9/11 since the day it happened. He's had a TV show doing it, I think Cable Access, and also a radio show on 9/11. And he's got some really interesting research on the Naudé brothers, and I think he's one of the only people left sort of researching that, and he'll tell you more about that. But so, Frank, welcome, and take it away.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'm looking back at the draft agenda, and it says Frank DeLucco will present a summary of his research critical of the iconic Naudé brothers video of the first World Trade Center event on 9/11. Just to clarify, I'm more of like of a relief pitcher. The starting pitcher left the ballgame in the eighth inning at a tie score, and we're going into extra innings, and I'm the relief pitcher. This guy that I'm going to be talking about, who created the website, Leslie Raphael, Scott, is primarily responsible for a lot of the work. I came in later and continued doing work with him. He has since passed away. So let me give a little précis of the Naudé brothers, who they are, for those who probably are not too familiar with it. This is a very long and complicated subject. I'm just going to touch maybe 5% of what's out there. So at the end, we can certainly ask questions. And what I'm looking for is for people to look at the Naudé brothers film 9/11, which won all these mainstream media awards, and then the critical website that was set up, knowing that it was a propaganda film, essentially. And I'm looking for feedback because I want to see if it's worthwhile to the truth community to move forward with this, perhaps produce a book and update the website in terms of its ability to be read. It's very confusing, and it's not easy to to edit it. So anyway, let me start with the précis of the Naudé brothers. Virtually everyone, internal or external to our truth movement, our truth community, is familiar with the iconic video clip of the first plane crashing into the North Tower, accidentally, supposedly captured by a twisting panning cameraman. Within our community, most are familiar with the video clip of the roundtable discussion of firemen describing their experiences. This clip was in Loose Change and in various other videos and DVDs produced over the last 10 or 15 years. One of the firemen describes the explosions, boom, 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 all the way down the building. And then there's the ground zero street level facing up clip of the second plane plowing into the South Tower. These film clips are from the mainstream media award-winning video 9/11, released in selected theaters in early 2002 and in DVD format later that year. This film was by the Naudé brothers, Jules and Gédéon, James Hanlon, and among others, and executive producer Susan Zielinski. More on her later. The purpose of the film, in my view and many people, is to guarantee that the first plane going into the North Tower would be captured. They were pretty sure, the perps, that the other buildings and other events at the Pentagon would be captured because everybody would be out there looking for it. But they needed to guarantee that they could get that first shock into a shot. They certainly succeeded in getting it, but I think they miserably failed in trying to portray that it was accidentally captured. The Naudé brothers claim to be born in Paris, yet our research shows that there's no record of saying that there's no record of them ever having been there or being born there. They claim to have attended an NYU film degree program in New York City. There's no record of that either. They are residents of the U.S. since the early 90s, but there is no record of them ever becoming naturalized American citizens. In the late 90s, they produced a film called Hope, Gloves, and Redemption, a documentary about an East Harlem, New York amateur boxer that went nowhere artistically or financially. We're questioning whether this was sheep-dipping to establish their bona fides as filmmakers. In early 2001, the Naudés teamed up with a nondescript former newspaper reporter and then current New York City Fire Department fireman, the aforementioned James Hanlon, to get permission from the city of New York to film a then probationary fireman, Tony Benetatos, and his training to become a full-fledged smoke eater. In pursuit of their documentary, they were living and filming at a New York City firehouse located at 100 Duane Street, just a few blocks from Ground Zero. On the morning of September 11th at about 8:15 a.m., an emergency call came in reporting a possible gas leak in the area. The crew of firemen, along with the Nordays, were following up on the report, and Jewel was filming the crew's response when he just happened to be in the right spot to capture the first plane slamming into the North Tower. Less than 20 minutes later, the other brother, Gideon, just happened to be in the shadow of the South Tower at street level and captured the second plane slicing into the South Tower. They won many awards for the so-called documentary, then seemed to drop out of sight for a few years. They produced In God's Name in 2007, interviewing world religious leaders to try to make sense in their own minds of the events of 2001. In 2013, they produced The President's Gatekeepers, interviewing for the most part presidential chiefs of staff. They had access to such bastions of openness as Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, James Baker III, and George H.W. and Rahm Emanuel. 2016 saw the release of CBS Television's The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, a look at the company's accomplishments and failures. The Nordays, closely involved with this, had full access to CIA personnel. A common factor in these productions is that CBS's Susan Zirinsky seems to play the role of executive producer, sometimes as part of a team. Zirinsky's role at CBS, in their own words, is senior executive producer for breaking news specials, such as those done in the aftermath of, now get this, Aurora, Colorado theater shootings, the elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and the Boston Marathon bombings. Could she be the gatekeeper? But I digress. Now, this is from a press release from CBS describing her own what do you call activities and what she's been doing. So, now we get to the. I've just mentioned who they were and the film that they made, which is 9/11. Now I'm going to discuss the website, which we had a link to put up in the proposed agenda. The website was created by one Leslie Raphael. Leslie was a Scot, and he's passed away, from the Glasgow area, who died in 2014. He's the son of a socialist fireman, and Les was decidedly on the left and correctly deduced that 9/11 was a false flag operation. His early research led him to the Norday fraud, which he pursued with tunnel vision ferocity. He believed that this path would lead to exposing the perps, since he had names of actual people that participated in the propaganda end of the operation. He was certainly angered by the perps, but also by the truth movement, which in his estimation, did not recognize the importance of the topic. His irascible nature did not endear him to too many people, and I can personally attest to that. He was a really rough guy to get along with. Leslie had health problems and was on a disability pension. He was not financially secure, so he pursued most of his early research at a local library. When he could afford a cheap computer terminal and internet access, he continued his research at home. He created the website that we would link to, and he wrote everything in native HTML code. He didn't use any other software to ease the burden of creating a website. And he found someone to host it, radio hostess and webmaster Deanna Spingola. Full disclosure, I became interested in the Norday angle and joined forces with Les around 2009. Again, he did most of the early work from his local library and later from home. He became a real expert in the geography of Lower Manhattan, having never been there. And it's amazing, having never been there, he knew it better or is equal to myself, who was a New York native. He became disenchanted with his first host. I then volunteered to take over the task of being the webmaster for the website. I further contributed to the effort by making timely updates as new material became available, did proofreading, made editorial suggestions, submitted a few FOIA requests, took some photos, obtained copyright status for him, and did a small amount of research. When he died in 2014, rather unexpectedly, his family, executors of his meager estate, agreed to transfer copyright ownership rights to me if I removed his byline from the homepage. He was not particularly liked by his family either, and some of his relatives considered him, as they say in Britain, a nutter. Now, why am I raising this topic now? I think Leslie's basic premise holds significant merit. We have names and addresses of the propaganda perps and could pursue them and their enablers and handlers. There is documentary evidence within the film, that is the 9/11 film by the Norde brothers, either purposefully or mistakenly left in, which has importance for other areas of 9/11 researches. I'll give you just three examples of that. The Proby fireman is filmed back at the firehouse sitting at the communication desk. A TV is on announcing a news flash about the Pentagon. The audio track on the film has him saying, "The Pentagon, the Pentagon's on fucking fire. War, this is war." Now, there's a clock on the wall next to the TV. It reads 9:30 a.m. in the film. There are numerous possibilities for this putative documentary evidence, none of them friendly to the official conspiracy theory or the film itself. Going on to another example, the roundtable discussion where some of the Duane Street firemen are fresh and spiffy at sometime after September 11th are discussing their observations of the progressive explosion in the towers. That's the one where they go boom, 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 and all they said all the stuff was breaking loose. Every 9/11 film since then has a film clip there. That comes from them, from the Norde brothers. The question remains is if they let it in accidentally or was done on to almost to tantalize us with something. Don't know. The absolutely good fortune to be in the right spot for the first airplane impact compounded by rushing to and being at the right spot for a close-up ground shot of the second impact less than 20 minutes later is credible evidence, in my mind, of foreknowledge of the event. And if that's the case, then we have people that are in on the deal. Anyway, cutting to the chase, here's my main reason for presenting this to everyone. The website, written in native HTML code, is very difficult to update and is not user-friendly. Before I undertake the task and expense of recreating and updating it, I want feedback from the community as to the importance and value in continuing this effort. I also want suggestions and criticisms about the basic content of the site. I'm also considering the website into a book, which is sometimes easier to hand out. People often take a book than sit down in front of a computer screen. Now, what can you guys do, and gals? First of all, let me state that what you've just heard is about only maybe 3 or 4% of the total story, and that's being generous at this point. First thing, get a copy of the original 2002 Filmmaker's Commemorative Edition of 9/11. Most libraries have it because it's considered a classic award-winning film. Watch it, beginning to end. It's a long film. There was also a 2006 edition, which is essentially the same, but with some added meaningless fluff. Two, visit the website. I think we gave a link to it. The link is frankresearch.info. Visit the website. Read it from beginning to end, which is a criticism of the film, pointing out its various anomalies. You need to do both. One without the other is meaningless. Forward me your thoughts, critiques, recommendations. Perhaps we can do it in another session, a monthly session, or you can email me. As a coda, I did get pushback from some in the movement after publicizing the Norde angles. They thought it might be demeaning to the families. Familiar words. We've heard that before. Final thought. I'm not into this stuff, but the anagram of Duane Street, that's where the firehouse was, where no firemen perished. Where no fire. It was the only firehouse that didn't have any deaths due to the events of 9/11. Anyway, the anagram of Duane Street is Nordes. I don't know if that has any meaning, but you never know what they can do. So that's my very brief presentation. I didn't want to bend people's ears, but I really would like for you to go and look at both the website and the original film and get back to me with your thoughts on this.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. That was succinct and good time management. We'll now go into question and answer mode. That means you press star 6 if you want to be in the queue to ask Frank a question, which you'll be able to do now that I've unmuted his microphone. So, star 6 if you have a comment or a question on what you've just heard. Nobody's lined up yet. Star 6 if you wish to make a comment or ask a question. Star 6.
It's Craig. I can make one if I don't think I can do the star 6 thing because I'm a a host?
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead, Craig. We're meeting a couple more. Go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, let me turn my speaker off. Hold on. I just want to say, Frank, I definitely think that this is a really important subject, and I really applaud you for being involved in it, because I think this is something that's struck me from the beginning as just I couldn't believe that they could be in that spot, and I don't know at that perfect moment, and I've read this somewhere, sort of an assessment of the various streets in that area where they could have been, and how many, or what the likelihood would have been that they could have been in a spot where they would have a clear view of the towers at that precise moment. And I believe that the assessment was that there was very, that the odds were heavily against that. They had to be basically in the perfect spot.
Yeah, that appears on the website, but okay, continue.
Is it? Okay, great. That's fantastic. So I guess I was wondering, and I'm sure, I think I'm going to have more. I'd like to really look into this, and I'm sure I'll have more thoughts or more questions. But I'm just wondering, do you know offhand whether we have any information that establishes whether, in fact, or how they came to be sent to that particular location to do this shot, and whether we actually even have it confirmed that they really were sent to that spot by the fire department?
Okay, yes, we do. Interestingly enough, in some of the FOIA requests, there supposedly was a gas leak at that intersection. And that intersection, I've walked around the area taking photos, and that's the only place that would get that north tower, tower building, and the upper two-thirds of it to be there. Any other place in the area would not work out. So they get a call, supposedly, an emergency call to go there to check a gas leak. We put a FOIA request in to say, where's that, that 911 call? They refused to release it. That's number one. Number two, what was released by the 9/11 Commission was the raw film that the Norday brothers had taken that morning. It's highly edited in the film. But the raw film actually shows them standing around for 10 or 15 minutes doing absolutely nothing. For 10 or 15 minutes, and then there's a guy there that's not in fireman's outfit looking at his watch, and all of a sudden everybody gets into place, and then he takes the photo. So that sounded to me like a setup.
Right. Absolutely.
So, and that's again from the raw film that was we had to go through hours and hours of it to look at. We see that. I mean it's a dead giveaway of what they were doing.
Is there raw film on the website?
No, it is not. One of the things it is not on the website. it is available. I do have it, and I had to. It's very long in terms of the size. The size of the file, and it's the way that when it was released, that it's not all that clear. They put stuff in it. With writing, this is not for public release. Blah blah blah, and all the other stuff. But sitting through it, I mean, I can eventually do that. But the point of having it on the website with low resolution and let it playing for 15 minutes showing them just hanging around, I don't know if that would get the same effect.
Okay. We'll go to our next questioner. That would be, I think, Lynn Bradbury. Go ahead, Lynn. Lynn Bradbury, you're up.
This is Lynn.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Hi, Frank. Thanks.
Hi.
It was all a little bit fast for me, but I didn't want to break in and say that. So what's the name of the website?
The website is frankresearch.info. You just type that in, it'll get
Frank,
there.
Frank Research?
Yeah, frankresearch.info.
Okay, and is most of this there that you've been talking about?
Oh, yes, absolutely. As I said, I probably only gave about 5% of what's on that website.
Okay.
There's many
great
other anomalies. Some of them are actually unbelievable. But just as important, as I had mentioned earlier, see if you can get a copy of 9/11, the film, the DVD, and watch that also.
Well,
you'll see
tell me again the name of the movie and who did it.
Nine/11.
Yeah.
And it's by the Norday. The film by Jewel and Gideon Norday.
Norday, okay.
N-A-U-D-E-T.
Can you see it on YouTube?
You know what? It might be up there. You know, I haven't looked recently.
I've seen it there.
And this is an old movie. A couple of, like you said, it was in 06, but it had been done earlier as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Either one is fine, because I've seen the 2006 one. All they did is they put in a couple of fluff things and saying, oh, it's 5 years now, I feel so bad, that type of stuff. It really doesn't add anything. What's important is what they purport to show of what they did on 2001, and there's nothing in the 2006 version that takes away from any of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ben. And then Wayne, you're up.
Yeah, thanks for the update. It's all very interesting. But the Naughty Brothers video, did that include some shots from the inside of the North or South Tower lobby?
Absolutely.
It seems to me that there was some really, really interesting researchable, research-worthy photographs and videos there that, in fact, show that there could not have been an explosion. What are the kinds of things are in there that you think should have, if it was a real propaganda piece, they would have taken out if they were even aware of their importance? Over.
Okay. There's sounds of explosions in the lobby, and everybody's looking around for one. I mentioned the thing about the firemen talking about the boom, 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 and then the thing about the Pentagon, where they show that thing where the clock says 9:30. What I think was going on was they rushed this out. They got it out. I remember seeing it in a theater in Greenwich Village, like in January, February of 2002. They rushed to get this film out. And the official story really hadn't congealed yet. The 9/11 Commission hadn't been there, hadn't come together yet, and hadn't put together the full story that they wanted to present. So they were sort of going blind. And that's why I think they left some of it in, because they didn't know the importance of what they were leaving in. They were flying blind. And for some reason, they weren't stopped. Also, the thing with the Pentagon, with the clock at 9:30, that scene, as far as I'm concerned, was filmed after 9/11. And at that point, they thought that it occurred at 9:30 for whatever reason. But that was the official story up to that point. So they got caught, perhaps, with their pants down after the fact. So they don't, they didn't realize that they were leaving up stuff that might be damaging to the official story.
Yeah, so Frank, let me just, I'm sorry to continue, but on this, you've raised this a number of times with the 9:30 time. You know what, you know what channel they were probably watching, there is the archives that tell you exactly what time these things were recorded. I've got the link for it someplace for many of the video archives, and you can find out exactly when it was being played. Because, I mean, as the criticism of clocks on the is that they're notoriously wrong, and my watches are always a good example of just how bad timepieces can be. So,
right.
But I think you can go back to the archives and find out exactly when that was being broadcast, and if that was captured in there, you know when it was. And so,
yes, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But that's true. But within that scene, that clip scene, the TV is only maybe 1/20th of the total frame thing. So, and the clock is right next to it. What I'm suggesting is that at the point when they reconstructed the scene, the official story was 9:30, and that's what they left in, whether it's true or not. But that gives another lie to the film that they said that they were doing that as it was, happening, but it wasn't. Like, this would indicate that they actually went back and filmed something later on to try to show that that's what it was, which again puts the lie to the fact that it was an unedited documentary.
Yeah, I understand the point. Thank you, Wayne.
Okay, so we got time for one more quickie. So, Paul, please be brief, and then we have to move on. Thank you. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, hi, Frank. How are you doing? I had two questions, short questions, I think. How do you know, put it this way, the films show the Naudette brothers there, or they do not show them as human beings there? I'm asking that because I don't know for sure who actually took the videos unless I see them in the videos. And the second question is, you said they were looking at their watches Why would that be significant? Because why would they know exactly what time the plane would be coming? You'd think that they would be looking at something else, like a GPS signal, or I don't know what. But the timing seems to be not the key, because they wouldn't know exactly when the plane would come.
Well, you may be right, and again, that may take more research. But at a certain point, after he looks at his watch, everybody gets into position to take the shot. So maybe they had gotten a phone call earlier from somebody that when the planes were over in Westchester, whatever, saying, okay, at their current rate of speed, they're going to be down there at 9:46 and 30 seconds, and you know they know what the plane's doing, and they're looking at their watches, which are coordinated. And then they look up. I'm not trying to defend it. I'm not saying you're wrong, but that might bear more research. The fact that they are doing nothing with a supposed gas leak, and don't forget, months earlier, 10 firemen were killed in Queens with a gas explosion. All of a sudden, they're very nonchalant in the raw footage of the film and not really caring. So that gives light to the fact that it actually was a gas leak. It was a ruse to get to that particular position. So.
Okay, and the other question about them being in the video themselves.
They are, which is interesting. Another criticism, again, I couldn't get into all these points. There's valid evidence, or I think significant evidence, that there may have been two or three cameramen going on. But participating in this. Because they show a shot of them leaving the firehouse to go there, but there's a shot from the outside of the fire truck leaving the firehouse. Well, that had to be a third cameraman to do that, which is very interesting. And there's one other thing. There's a film of them walking into the firehouse around noontime, which is also interesting. And it's in the film. They're saying, oh, man, it's terrible down there. The heat of the fires, that's what melted the steel and the buildings came down. They were already setting the story on that within the film. They let that stay in the film. But within 3 hours, they were already saying that in the film that was going to be the line of what brought the buildings down.
Okay. Thanks.
So, anyway, a lot of stuff in there.
Okay. Thank you again for your succinct presentation, Frank, and hopefully others will spend some time looking at the website and giving Frank the feedback he's requesting. Be sure to put that website in the minutes so that it will be there for everyone's reference. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. Now we'll move on to Cheryl, who needs no introduction, and I'm sure she'll introduce this topic on her own. Cheryl, go ahead.
Okay. So the left forearm we're talking about, correct? This is where...
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Forum update.
Yes. Okay. So probably everyone knows a little bit about it, but I'll just give a quick overview. Kat McGuire and I had planned, last year we did 6 panels on a deep state track at the left forum, all accepted, no problem. This year we have 5 panels, and we submitted them all, and the first three of them were banned, because some guy named Spencer Sunshine wrote into a letter to the left forum saying that we were far right wingers and anti-Semitic, and I can't remember what else. And he had gone into each of our, you know, bio like of each of us, and didn't want particularly Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer to speak, and there may have been someone else, I can't remember now, but so. You know, we all responded to that in many ways. They shared it with us, which we were grateful for. But then we submitted our panels, and we didn't have a lot of the same speakers, but we did have Kevin Barrett. And so they banned 3 panels. One of them was on 9/11, which we had Barbara Honegger, Richard Gage, and Kevin Barrett. They banned that one. Then they banned the false flag stage scripted mass psyop events that had Kevin Barrett, David Lindorf, and Ole Demigard. And then they also banned the terrorism, fake enemies, fraudulent wars with Michael Springman, Anthony Hall, and Kevin Barrett. And so, you know, we complained. A lot of you wrote letters, which I really appreciate. Thank you for doing that. And they never gave us a reason. They wouldn't respond to us. And they just sent a second letter to us saying, a very official letter saying, no, these panels are banned. So then they accepted one, we have one called Co-opting the Left, Infiltration by the Corporate State to Neutralize Resistance, with Kevin Zeese of, well, I forget the name of his website now, is it Progressive? I forget. And then Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. And we had a third person on that, Margaret Flowers, who has since dropped out. But they approved of that one, and Glenn Ford is their keynote speaker, so they probably couldn't cancel that one as one of their keynote speakers. And then we had another one, Political Correctness, The Dangers of Thought Crime Police, and that was Anthony Hall, Jeremy Roth, Kushel, and Joy Kariga sharing their stories about being harassed by the Zionists and what's happened to them. And they approved of that panel. And then on Monday, we just got an email from them saying that they had a German organization complain to them about Anthony Hall, that he was a Holocaust denier, anti-Semitic. And then they said they had hundreds of letters supporting that. And this German organization apparently works close with them and has tables and panels at the Left Forum, and they said they were going to withdraw if Anthony Hall was allowed to speak. So they wrote us a letter and said, you know, you're out, we're canceling this panel. They never ever, you know, like people have have bought travel plans and bought tickets. They never offered to reimburse, you know, they never, none of that. So, and they called Anthony Hall a Holocaust denier in the email, which is really, you know, libelous because, you know, he's not. And anyway, and they didn't contact us for our opinions on anything about this German company, what they were saying or whoever they are. And so now we're down to one panel being accepted and four being banned. And so someone, a friend of ours in New York, got angry about this, and he has rented a space for us. And then he rented also a backup space. So we have two spaces rented. If they kick us out of the first one, then we have the second one. And we're not announcing the location until 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. All five of the panels are on Sunday. We'll announce the location at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and you can go to nolizeradio.org/secret to find out where they are. And then, because we don't want the Zionists to get a hold of that and then cancel us again. So, and we're afraid that they might even find out at 9 o'clock and put pressure on the venue and get us canceled. So that's why we have the second location. And so we're ready to go if that happens. So that's where we're at. And that's it. So if anyone has any questions about that, please ask.
Cheryl, I understand that No Lies Radio, it will be broadcasting your other forums, correct? The ones that you're doing?
Yes, thank you, Ken, for reminding me of that. Yeah, No Lies Radio with Alan Reese. They're going to be live streaming it, except for the one panel that was accepted will be videotaping and airing it later because we have two at the same time. So, so they'll all be live streamed, and you can go to No Lies Radio to see them.
Very good. Okay. Yeah. So we're still in question and answer mode, so if anybody would like to ask a question or make a comment, press *6. I'm going to unmute you, Frank, because I had to mute you, but you're free to ask a question, too, if you wish. Let's go to Wayne Kosky. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, Cheryl, thanks for doing all this. I'm going to be in New York for the Left Forum. I hadn't planned on being there, but I guess I'm going to. Are we going to be handing out advisable to hand out flyers? Can you use some help down there to let them know that there's a mystery panel that's been banned? I'm glad to help you out on this.
Yes, we have a flyer we're putting together that explains that we've been banned and why, and we have all our panels listed and how to get to the secret location. So, yeah, if you want to do that, that'd be great, Wayne. And we also have a table in the main area there. It's called the Deep State Panel Table.
Right.
Or the Deep State Table. So if anyone is down there and wants to look us up, that's where you can find us to hang out.
Great. I think the 9/11 Truth Action Project is going to have something there, a table there also. So.
Oh, great. Okay.
So I'll do what I can to support you on that. Okay.
All right. Thanks,
Wayne.
Appreciate it.
I just see that Kat McGuire is online, and she was going to co-present with Cheryl on this, so I'm going to open up her line right now. And
okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Cheryl. Yeah, hi.
Can you hear me?
Want to add? Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Cheryl. Thank you for covering. I ended up going to the JFK documentary that was playing nationwide. And I'll just really, really briefly report it. It was a huge theater, and there were about four people in it. So that was kind of shocking. But in any event, I'm sorry I missed what you had to say, Cheryl. I probably knew everything. But I did want to say that there is an unheralded person here that really needs to be mentioned, and that's Alan Reese. He has gone above and beyond, and is just really pulling it together and is going to be the person to make it bigger than what he is. So I just want to make sure I do a shout out there for Alan Reese. And that also we're going to be getting a press release out probably by tomorrow. It's so delayed because of all of the changes, but a press release from us will be officially coming out. So thank you, Cheryl, for covering for me.
Yeah, and I also wanted to mention that I think my understanding is we were covered this whole issue on Bonnie Faulkner's show today.
Yes, Kevin was interviewed. He was interviewed about Manchester, but I'm sure he brought it up. And Bonnie did a live announcement on KPFA, and I gave her our draft press release. It's almost finished. And Bonnie forwarded our draft press release to WBAI, who the three guys she forwarded to, hopefully they'll make a live announcement as well.
Great.
Okay, and then Paul.
I have a couple of questions. First one's easy. Have you been able to identify the German organization? Because, I mean, there must not be very many German organizations that have lots of panels this weekend.
We haven't even had the time to look, Paul, but that's a really good idea. And I was planning on writing to the Left Forum and asking them who this German organization is. I doubt they'll tell us, but we will look.
Right, I doubt
that.
They'll tell you too.
Yeah. So, and then they may have a table or something. So we'll try and figure that out.
Now, I want to ask another question, and I hope I don't know if I'll get it across in a way which sounds camaraderie, but I have to ask it. It's not unreasonable. Now, I'm not making any accusations. I'm trying to ask a question. It's not unreasonable for a left organization to worry about provocateurs. It's not unreasonable. I mean, so the question is, forget about the exact things that people have said which are being used against you. But do you think it should be a free speech forum in which anybody who has anything intelligent to say should be able to speak, or do you accept that a left forum should be able to have some kind of definition of what left means and apply it?
Well, Paul, the thing is that they accepted us last year for the same exact topics, no problem. And if they didn't get this letter from Spencer Sunshine saying that we were, you know, far right wing and anti-Semitic Holocaust deniers, they probably would have kept us on. So since they accepted us all last year, so I don't think that. I don't think that's the issue that you're, you know, and obviously any organization has the right to speak wherever they want, but I don't think they have the right to get one letter from some guy making assertions and then cancel us.
Right.
So,
okay.
And, you know, after they've last year.
Right. And did they, as I understand from your report, they didn't give you the opportunity to respond, right? They just did it. Is that right?
Right, and when we sent them letters asking, okay, why did you do this? You know, why are we being canceled? And they would not respond to us.
But important for me is that they didn't even, I mean, if due process, quote unquote, whatever that's supposed to mean, due process would seem to be you get a letter of accusation, you go to the other party and ask them to respond first before you make a decision,
That with Spencer Sunshine's letter. But then they canceled us anyway, and now they're saying that they've got some German group who didn't want our fourth panel there.
Okay,
so,
can you tell me a little bit about how you responded?
We sent out the letters, so a lot of people have seen them. You know, everybody responded differently, but they we challenged what they said. You know, they made fun of, like last year we had Richard Nolan speaking, and he was Richard Dolan, I'm sorry, and he was speaking on false flags, but he happens to be also into UFOs, which he didn't talk about at all at the panel, and they had his little blurb about him saying how ridiculous he was, that he believed that, and this is, you know, the kind of people we are, and we shouldn't be allowed at the left forum and stuff. So, you know, I responded to that and said that I don't know if there's UFOs or not. It wasn't part of what we talked about, and I said he was in good company because some Canadian, Paul Hellyer, I forget what his title was, thinks there are. So, you know, and I gave him a copy of Hellyer speaking. So, and, you know, and I, it's just that kind of stuff. So we responded to everything they said, you know, with sort of a correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for your explanation.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Paul. And thanks, Cheryl, for that update. I know that everybody has been tuned into this question and wishes you all well and your alternative presentations coming up in New York. And, again, if you want to see the live screening, No Lies Radio will be carrying it. So that's the people you want to get in touch with and support in the meantime, okay? All right.
And I just want to say, I do hope that people will support No Lies Radio because he has really done, as Kat said, has really gone all the way with that.
Yep. Okay. And now it's time for our illustrious secretary to take his secretarial hat off and expatiate a bit on a recent blog post on the subject of focusing on defeating the official story. So, Craig, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you. I should mention before I take my secretarial hat off that we have six more people have joined the call since I did the role. So I'll just mention that we have David Cole, Dick Attlee, Kat McGuire, Greg Longo, Sue Serpa, and Jonathan Mark as well. So we're getting up to a good number. Okay, so I've had the idea for quite some time to address the subject of how the 9/11 truth movement can most effectively present its case to those who are not acquainted with our evidence or who are not terribly open to the evidence. How can we in the movement come together and agree on enough evidence to make a clear and focused case to the uninitiated? And how are we going wrong in doing that now? With the recent events in the world, including the Trump presidency and all the distractions that come with that, and various wars, Syria and things like that, one false flag after another, it's really becoming harder and harder for 9/11 truthers to keep any kind of focus. There are many ways to approach, I think, a potential newcomer to 9/11 truth, and many of us think that we have the magic formula to reach others because we think our theory is the best. But I would argue that it's not the individual theories that can most easily be brought into alignment, creating a coherent message. It's the focus on what's impossible in the official story. I'm advocating the idea of simplifying and focusing the message by sticking to the actual evidence and how the evidence contradicts official claims. And actually, I think the whole discussion we were having about the Nade brothers, I think, is a really good example of that. Anyway, this means not proclaiming with certainty that a cruise missile hit the Pentagon or that Flight 93 was shot down. It also means not preparing to go to war with other truthers about which type of explosive was used to bring the towers down. This approach is essentially the one taken by David Ray Griffin in his many books on 9/11, completely methodical with every point sourced. In reading his body of work, it would be very difficult for anyone to believe the official story. Some, unfortunately, including Griffin's own 9/11 consensus panel, would have us leave out any evidence that might appear to be controversial, I put that in quotation marks, so that we can avoid arguments and division. This is sort of the let's focus on what we agree on approach, but I think we could also call it the lowest common denominator approach. While I agree that there are times that we have to put aside differences for the greater good, I do not believe that we should ever jettison crucial evidence that shows the official story to be false. Of course, we all have the right to advocate for any theory and that we believe is supported by the evidence and to conduct any research to determine what actually did happen. I would never want anyone to be censored from doing so. But what we end up doing much of the time is arguing among ourselves about these theories. And this is not helpful when it comes to convincing the outside world. I would also point out that when we push a particular theory about what did happen, We throw the burden of proof back on us. If we show how the government can't account for the evidence, then the burden is on them. One thing I find very troubling is the number of truthers who claim that we should bear the burden of proof. They want the parts of the government, parts of the government account to be considered true unless we show exactly what happened instead. I also would like to mention that I think it's entirely appropriate and essential to relate an event like 9/11 to other false flags and to show historical patterns. In fact, this must be done. But without a strong case about the 9/11 evidence to start with, the parallels to other events are likely to be more difficult to reveal. We have to consider exactly which case we are attempting to make. Are we sticking to the safest evidence so that we won't be criticized? Are we trying to please the mainstream media by watering down what we believe? Some would have us talk about Building 7, the towers, and nothing else. They might get into the impossibility of Hani Hanjour flying a 757, but not much beyond that. In my article, I gave an example of John Gold, who's a frequent contributor to 9/11 Blogger. And he goes to the extreme of saying we should stay away from controlled demolition and just go on the basis that we've been lied to and that's all we're willing to say, which I think, you know, while it may be a starting point, is extremely weak. One of the things that I think has done a lot to derail the truth movement over the past decade or more is the fight over the Pentagon. Many sincere truthers simply want to ignore this part of the story because they have become convinced it is divisive. But I would argue that this so-called division is contrived. And unfortunately, many of us have been fooled into seeing it as genuine. As I have written in articles before, I believe that there has been a disinformation campaign in progress for a dozen years or more that seeks to use the Pentagon event to divide the movement and to disqualify the powerful Pentagon evidence. I don't say that everybody who pushes a large plane impact is part of this campaign, but I believe some are. We have been pushed by this small group of truthers in the direction of believing more and more of the official story, with respect to the Pentagon particularly. This group appears to spend almost no time at all challenging that story, and what they say about the Pentagon is often indistinguishable from what debunkers and official story supporters say. It is from this group that the supposed division comes, I would argue. I don't believe this is about legitimate research. I see it as an exercise in spin. It is an effort to manipulate the movement into thinking that opinion is shifting in the direction of the government's 757 story. My great fear is that this is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. At this point, I'd like to remind everybody why I believe that the Pentagon is so essential to the case that the truth movement is making and has to make. First, the Pentagon event appeared to be an attack by an external enemy on the military of the United States, providing justification for a military response. And secondly, if the evidence shows that a large plane did not crash into the Pentagon and that explosives were used to simulate a crash, then there is no other entity than the U.S. government itself that could have staged this. Simply proving the official account of a crash to be false proves that an inside job took place. Now, let me take an element of the story just to illustrate my point. It's the contention of David Chandler and others that the wings of Flight 77 were blown into confetti, and that this is what we see on the ground in the area around the heliport. There is not a shred of evidence to support this claim. Instead of pointing out that it is impossible for the wings and tail section to simply disappear, we have truthers saying that this is just what we would expect to see. On the towers, I think it makes no sense whatsoever for some to attack a group like AE-911 Truth for its contention that thermite played a part in the destruction of the towers, instead arguing that mini-nukes or directed energy weapons were responsible. We all agree that some form of explosive destruction took place and that the buildings did not come down as a result of plane impacts. Why would we want to split over the type of material used? Why refight a battle that AE and the movement have effectively won? And AE does not claim that thermite did the whole job anyway. In fact, Niels Harrit, an interview I did with him a couple of years back, told me that it was not even the primary cause of the destruction of the buildings. In other words, something else was used to blow the buildings up. and we don't know exactly what that was. But the controlled demolition position is a solid one, backed by overwhelming evidence, and it is essential to our efforts to educate others. As for Shanksville, it is beyond obvious that a 757 in the form of Flight 93, or any 757 for that matter, did not crash in a field and bury itself underground, as the official story contends. This absurd claim is deserving of much more truth or attention than it has received until now. But we get into trouble when we speculate about what happened instead. We can exchange some speculation as long as it's clearly labeled as such, but we really must lead with the facts about how the official story is false. With Shanksville, this is not hard to do. And that is really what we want to convince the public of. If they see that the story is false, then they might just want to dig deeper. They might just be willing to look at other aspects of 9/11. And just to wrap up here, it's reasonable for truthers to shy away from far-fetched and unfounded claims when presenting their case to the world. To this extent, we should be aware of how our statements will be perceived. But to ignore glaring impossibilities in the official story just to appear credible and to keep the peace is a self-defeating exercise. And to allow a small minority to push point after point of the official story while only being minimally challenged is much worse. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So there's Craig's summary, and who would like to make a comment or a question? Star 6, if you'd like to respond to what Craig has just said. Star 6. And not surprisingly, first in line is Wayne Kosky. Go ahead, Wayne. Whoops, I'm sorry. Barton Bruce jumped up there first. Barton, you're first. Go ahead.
Okay. You didn't mention, and I haven't heard from anybody for quite a while, and I think it was out sort of publicly, but if it wasn't, it needs to get out more, was the Dakota file, the PDFs. That's an elaborate thing. Someone spent some effort to put together, and it's a big monkey wrench in a lot of things. And I think it's well, whatever. But I'll just stop there. But if you don't know what they are, I think if I can find them on which disk drive they're on. I have not only the ones that went to A, 9/11 Truth, but I also have the ones that for pilots for 9/11 Truth, I think, got the other set I have. And I'd sent those off to an ex-CIA PhD who was, you know, 17 years in Europe and is a PhD in actually history. But he works, he works at Council for National Interest, one of the two places. That's where Alison Weir is president. And her other one is, of course, If Americans Knew. It's Phil Giraldi, and he would have probably forwarded it to friends, but certainly had some comments about it. But it's a lot of bullshit, but someone went to a lot of trouble to get that out there. And I think it might have been sheep-dipping the obvious suspects, because it blames them quite openly, but there's enough lies in there that can poison pills that can make it look totally incredible. If you go out and say, look at this, they're obviously guilty. Well, you can prove in many ways in there that it's bullshit, so that then, of course, they're not guilty, even though they are. Anyway, that's all. I just wondered if anybody else worries about that particular set of information the way I periodically do. That's it.
Yeah, it took me a minute to remember. I remembered the name, but I couldn't place it, and then the light bulb went off, I guess. I haven't heard about it in a while, but I mean, I do remember it got a lot of attention for a short time after it came out, but I don't know that I sort of have any new thoughts about it. But
well, the key thing is that there's a lot of very, what's ostensibly very technical detail, the specific kinds of explosive down to, you know, fractions of a small unit of measure for depending upon which place it was being put, and all kinds of other gory details. And, but basically a lie. And someone went to great work to produce that and then was essentially, I think, sheep-dipping the guilty parties, or what I think a lot of people would assume would be the guilty parties. Supposedly, the guilty parties are not yet to be proven, but wondered if some sort of extended investigation of that could in fact help prove who did what, or at least, you know, paint them in a worse picture than they're already in.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that comment, Barton. Wayne, you were actually first, so go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. Thanks, Craig, again. First of all, I have an announcement to make. This is the first time it's been publicly made, is that because of the Pentagon issue, the board and of 9/11 Truth Action Project and myself are separating. I'm retiring from the board. The 9/11 Truth Action Project will be focusing on the best evidence, which is effectively the architects and engineers, as the centerpiece and actually the only piece as the evidence for 9/11, because it is the most credible and least disruptive in doing outreach. The Pentagon issue, as Craig, you pointed out quite rightly, has been divisive, and that's why I've decided that it's time to retire from that venue, from that that organization. With that said, your contention that that the best evidence is something besides the large plane impact is refuted by all the evidence that I've presented. The fact that there's a tiny wall that's made out of Jenga blocks held together, when it crumbles, you can only see tiny fractions of the corners of the blocks that made it up damaged. No rebar. So there's the columns on the inside are all bowed in the same direction. So there's for you to say that there is overwhelming evidence for something besides a large plane impact belies the facts. And I'll terminate my comments there, and if you want to respond, go ahead. Over.
Well, I don't know that this is necessarily the appropriate time to just get into a straightforward discussion about the evidence. I mean, obviously, I've made my position in the two debates and a few other occasions very clear as to where I stand. I mean, and this is, in fact, as I'm trying to get across, I hope it came across, the Pentagon issue is one of the reasons why I thought about, well, how can we move forward in a way that doesn't dilute our evidence, but at the same time doesn't focus on, you know, what you focus on? I mean, I would sort of, I don't know if this is appropriate for me to ask you a question, Wayne, but and I'm actually very interested in your announcement, but you know, I'm kind of wondering why it is that the only thing you talk about when it comes to the Pentagon is well, the only comments you make are in support of specific points that are part of the official story. That seems to be all you talk about. So I would throw that back at you.
Let me answer that directly right now, and that is because those comments I make are on this call with the 9/11 Truth leadership, and the 9/11 Truth leadership needs to hear this stuff. I have been terribly disappointed by the 9/11 Truth leadership because they don't pay attention to the evidence. I do not do this out in the general public, and when I do go out and do talk about the Pentagon in public, I won't be naming names. I'll be just pointing to the evidence and say, if you want to be a Sherlock Holmes, here's your magnifying glass. This is what you look at. This is what it shows. But I talk about this stuff endlessly, you might say, on these calls because this is the venue to talk to not the general public, but the so-called 9/11 Truth leadership that needs to know what the evidence is. That's all. Thanks, Ogle.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. Next is Frank.
Yeah, Frank here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good. You know, there's something called the consensus panel set up by David Ray Griffin, among others, where they were trying to do like something somewhat of what you're speaking of. And I've looked at it. I haven't looked at it recently, but it came to mind now as you brought this up, maybe a year or two ago. And it seemed, and I don't mean to be demeaning of the work that these people are involved in, but it seemed wishy-washy. It didn't seem like it's something that really would grab you. So if we can get to the lowest common denominator, as you say, I don't think that that's going to grab people. I think you have to have a little level of controversy, perhaps. It shows that you're human, whatever, there's disagreements, we're not all dead set. It's like, you know, you're not bringing a Bible, this is the truth. No, we don't have that. It has to be there has to be some sort of struggle that people see, and they see that you're actively trying to come to the truth. It's a very general comment I'm making, but hopefully I'm getting across what I'm trying to say.
No, I think you are, Frank, and I think what I said was actually very much in agreement with what you just said. I mentioned the consensus panel, but not in a positive way. I have great issue with. I mean, I think the points that they've adopted are fine as far as they go. I don't look at any of those points and say, well, those shouldn't be it. Those shouldn't be there. But I think the problem is, first of all, they absolutely fail to deal with the Pentagon. The strongest evidence of the Pentagon. And that is not a surprise, given the makeup of the panel and given the structure of how points are approved. I mean, it only takes four people to vote against a point to block it. And we know that there are enough people on that consensus panel who support the large plane impact position that virtually guarantees that we'll never get any points adopted that go against that. So I think I'm not advocating a consensus approach at all. That's, in fact, I'm specifically saying that's not strong enough. That's why I say that we need to look at the official story and at least have this. Doesn't mean that we have to adopt be all in lockstep and everything, but just maybe put more focus on here's what they're saying, here's why it can't be true. And not so much fighting over things like, I mean, I've seen so many truthers who say like, oh, it was definitely a, you know, Tomahawk missile for sure. I mean, look, you know, look at the hole in the wall. It's obviously a missile. And of course, they're just basing it on the shape of the hole in the wall. That's the whole reason they think that, and they have no evidence for it. But, you know, everybody, I mean, a lot of people say that. So I think it would be more effective if we just looked at the things that we can prove are false, and then we wouldn't be all splintering on theories. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Frank. And Dick Atlee. Go ahead, Dick.
I'm reminded of the Beatles song, Strawberry Fields, where there's a line on which the pretty miss is selling poppies from the tray, and she feels as if she's in a play, but she is anyway, which is a lot of applications in a lot of different ways to me. But when I was reading your article, Craig, it struck me that way, basically, that you're saying we should avoid the things which create dissension, and then you go on to very strongly advocate your position on the Pentagon, which, you know, having listened to endless debates in this forum about that, there are points that people raise on both sides that are very, to me, very strong and yet are mutually contradictory, which to me indicates that we really don't know what's going on. And I'm just troubled by the fact that you keep saying that, totally denigrating the opposing point on that, and I can't figure out whether this is just an aside or whether you're proposing that your view be included in the things that you feel we really can say in this ideal world of not alienating people.
Well, I'm not overly concerned about not alienating people. I mean, I think I'm saying that by challenging the official story and by trying to communicate to people that the official story is false, then we can perhaps avoid some of these internal arguments that seem to be endless. I mean, I think an argument, I mean, for example, you know, the video evidence. I mean, we have some really strong, hard evidence that video was tampered with. And that should be a consensus point, as far as I'm concerned. I think Massimo Mazzucco made that very clear in his film, and he, you know, and also just the fact that just the complete absence of large pieces of wreckage outside the building. I mean, this is the official story says that a 757 crashed there. Well, I think we can make a very strong case that the physical evidence just doesn't support that. So that's what I'm suggesting we put forward. I'm not saying that we should adopt my pet theory. In fact, if you'll notice, when people, you know, people like to talk about the flyover all the time. I prefer not to go in that direction because I'm not pushing my pet theory. I'm saying the evidence, the physical evidence that we see at that site does not support a large plane having just crashed into that building. And that, so I think, I know it sounds like, and I think I even made the point in the article that I know it sounds like I'm doing exactly what I'm telling people not to do because I'm pushing a theory. But that's not really what I'm doing. What I'm doing is I'm saying this story can't be true.
This is why I'm saying the pretty Miss Fields is if she's in a play, but she is anyway, because I really, you know, I have tremendous respect for a lot of the work you're doing. It's incredibly valuable. But in this case, I think you are doing what you say you're not doing. And your pet theory is that no big plane hit the Pentagon. I'm sympathetic with that theory, but it's nevertheless, to me, your pet theory. And you might be better off if you just drop that. I mean, I know you're passionately attached to it, and there's plenty of evidence that does seem to support that theory. But the fact is, there are a lot of people, and I think Wayne is one of them, who sincerely believe, based on evidence they're looking at, which contradicts yours, that they're on the right side. And this is exactly what I think you're trying to avoid. And to me, to say that anything that supports the official theory or official story has to be rejected is a reactionary statement. It's simply saying that we're not going to look at anything that even closely resembles the official story. I mean, there's plenty of things about it. You could have a big plane that was, you know, run by remote control. That's you know, the big plane's there, but it's a contradiction to the official story because it was virtually impossible to fly it that way. So it's for a human being to fly it that way. So I'm just thinking you might get further, and other people probably disagree with me, if you just dropped this argument, because if you just sit back and look at what's been happening over the past year on this teleconference, we just go around and around and around, and everybody is dug into their position and keep asserting the same things over and over. And that violates what it seems the spirit of what you're trying to do is. Anyway, that's enough. I won't be raised any further.
Right. I do want to respond to that. First of all, I don't think you say we go round and round. I think that actually supports the argument that I'm making. Because if you noticed in the surveys that were done following the three debates, the people who listened to those debates, as far as I can tell, I would conclude from the results that the people overwhelmingly support the same position, roughly, that I support. Overwhelmingly. I mean, in the debate with Wayne, it was 17 to 1. With Barbara, it was 10 to 2, but we were debating a different aspect of it. So I don't think this is the whole point I'm trying to make. I think this controversy, this division that we keep hearing about, and we keep thinking, oh, we're just never going to resolve this. Think about why we're not resolving it. We're not resolving it because there is a group, which is not even a large group, that is pushing points of the official story and nothing else. So, you know, I don't feel that I can let it go and drop it, as you're suggesting, while they continue to push and push and push. Because the result, if they're successful, the result is the Pentagon is useless to us. Some of that very strong evidence is useless to the movement. And I think it's important.
I'm not saying you should drop it from your own dialogue. I'm saying it might be better to drop it from the effort you're trying to make in trying to remove dissension. That, to me, that's where it's dysfunctional. I would make the same point you do in any discussions that I'm involved. But
thank you, Dick. I think your point is clear, and thank you for the response. Barton is back again for a second comment. So, Barton, you're going to make this very quick because we're already out of time on this question, okay? So just make it very, very quick.
Okay. Very quickly, does anybody remember what I remember, which was a picture of that section of the wall that had collapsed there where when it collapsed, there was a file cabinet with a piece of paper on it that wasn't charred or anything, so no fireball was anywhere near it. But anyway, I remember that wall with a I'm going to call it small hole, much smaller than the diameter of the plane, more like a missile. And but the wall had not collapsed at all, and there was this big hole there, and it wasn't near the bottom. It was up sort of in the middle of the building or even a little higher. And it was juxtaposed by somebody on the video with a hole in a palace or something in Iraq. And this was a missile going in, not a plane. And then there's been no more talk about it, or am I getting deaf in my old age?
I really
clear to me that I remember, because I remember the juxtaposition of it and all that.
Okay, thank you. Please quickly. Go ahead.
Was it not the C-ring hole that was superimposed on the missile?
The C-ring is that rounded like a hut.
Yeah.
Which was that's down at the ground level, and that's a rather large hole. This is I would call it a smaller hole. It's a round hole with no,
right,
like an upside down U. The C-ring one was the one that was blown out by shape charges from the inside, presumably.
Right. I think that, I mean, the only thing I could imagine that you would be talking about would be the hole on the second floor of the building, which is very narrow, like 15 feet across, and all the rest of the damage is on the ground floor. So that's the only thing
okay.
I can think of. But it's not exactly round.
Excuse me, Barton. This is really off the subject, so we're going to have to end it here. Thank you for your comment. Okay, so now we'll give Jonathan Mark his opportunity to update us on about three items and offer us a suggestion for outreach to the student population on the upcoming anniversary of 9/11. So, Jonathan, let me find you and unmute your microphone so you can let us know about all that good stuff. Hang on. Uh-oh. Jonathan, if you're muted yourself, you have to press *6 to unmute, okay? Well, we'll just bring you in on the Q&A. That'll work. Go ahead, Jonathan. You're up.
Okay. You can hear me?
Yep.
Okay. thanks, everybody. As a segue from the last discussion, I would say I'm going to start off with talking about the recent Flyby News update. We placed it on YouTube, and it was inspired by my local newspaper doing an article on 9/11 called Greenfield Doing Its Part to Educate 9/11. And this is an editorial that the paper was supporting, which was basically talking about the youth of how they know nothing about 9/11. They don't know how to feel about it. So they were presenting different forums and different books for them to read to educate the students. So they're really miseducating the students based on the official version, but it kind of inspired me to write the reply to that editorial, and I requested that it gets published as a My Turn op-ed, and haven't received a negative or a positive yet. It's still pending, I guess. But meanwhile, I read it on YouTube, and I published it at flybynews.com. And it's generally agreeing with what we were all talking about. You know, after finding Valley 9/11 Truth, because so few people would even talk about 9/11, it was like a refreshing element just to find a few people willing to talk about it. And then, you know, we educated ourselves with David Ray Griffin videos. And one of the things that he said that stuck with me was the main response that somebody has when he would propose the evidence to them is, I don't want to know the truth. I mean, if that's what the truth is, I'd rather live in some sort of make-believe world. And then that's why the article was called Denial, Cognitive Dissonance, and September 11th. And I explained this is why the students are uneducated about it, because no one will speak about it. And so why should they know about it or how to feel about it? Especially when they do speak about it, they don't deal with the unanswered questions and the obvious elements that people are ignoring. Exactly what you're talking about, the building was falling down as if there was a controlled demolition, and that there was evidence removed at the scene of a crime.
Excuse me, Jonathan, it seems to me that you're fading. Your voice keeps fading. Does anybody else hear that as well?
I'm sorry, do you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll continue. I couldn't really hear you too well. So, anyway. Say again?
You're still on, Jonathan.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was one point, and I hope people do go to the YouTube channel with the title Denial, Cognitive Dissonance, and September 11. You can also go to flybynews.com, and I have a link to that YouTube right under the first paragraph under our tour, and you'll see Denial, Cognitive Dissonance, and September 11. I would like to get more comments because it creates more of a community when people respond. So, and, you know, there's so much interest and depth in this group. So I kept it very simple about, you know, what we thought was the main issue regarding that people just don't want to know about it. And so far that keeps coming about to be true. And so it's not being published yet. I can see that people have a high level of resistance to dealing with it because it makes them feel lost and scared. So I personally think that 9/11 needs to combine with other issues like the peace movement, like what Cheryl was doing there, and also the moon landing hoax. There's no question at all that science has been traded in for a military psychological operation in that issue, as difficult as it is for even 9/11 truthers to accept. But that evidence is going to keep showing itself until they prove it. And so until they can show buildings can fall down by, their official versions or that they can get outside of low Earth orbit with astronauts safely protected, we should be skeptical and we need to start combining these issues. I also want to bring up that Tony Rook, the filmmaker for Incontrovertible, is working on a new film regarding the University of Alaska study about World Trade Center Building 7. And he's looking for any help. He asked me if I knew of any investors for 9/11 truth movies. He's looking for 5,000 plus. And that you should get in touch with Tony Rook, and I can help you with that if you can't find him on the web. He's pretty accessible. And I believe the Alaskan study will come out with their final report this summer. And they've already came out with that there's no way that Building 7 could have collapsed, according to the... All this work is good, and I think that's the update. If anyone has any comments, questions, please reply.
Okay, so if you have a comment or a question, *6, and I'm going to have to somehow find a way to unmute Jonathan's microphone here. Jonathan, I'm going to turn you off here and then turn the microphone back on. There we go. Okay, so *6, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, first up is Wayne. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, this is probably more of a comment. Jonathan, just to let you know, we're working on getting your article published on our newsletter. I thought it was really good. I'm concerned about the curriculum issues. 9/11 is being taught as, how it's being taught. I think it's a great way to, approach and challenge the boards of education, things like that. But I think your article, which is focused on the misinformation that's being planted in the upcoming generation, is really on target. And I appreciate you doing that, and hopefully we'll get our article posted in the very near future. It's in editorial review, editorial kind of, it's with our editor right now. Sorry, over.
Good, thank you so much.
Thank you, Wayne. And Bill Wilt. Bill?
Hi. Just a passing observation that there's not enough humor in this movement, and that you know, if we were to just laugh the official story out of the room, that might be you know, certainly one way to go. As an example, most people don't realize that the upholstery of the plane that crashed in Shanksville was made of moleskin. So there's a large sports team, they had a lot of moleskin tape. And when the plane hit the ground, it woke the moles up because of the, you know, the shock of the impact, and they just burrowed like hell to get out of there, and they dragged the plane probably 10 to 15 miles south, so I have no idea how far, but that was it. That's one example.
Ah, that's a great theory, Bill. Okay. All right, so anybody else want to make a comment or ask a question of Jonathan?
Do you still hear me, Ken?
Yeah, you're still up, Jonathan. Yeah. Your microphone's open.
I just want to also mention an update for Bart Jordan. He's having still, you know, health problems, but he's still making a lot of advancements. And he, I believe, in the excerpts that I've already posted on his presentation from the September 7th interview, that he proved that he provided NASA with the orbital positions for recording the Cydonia region for the Mars Viking mission in 1976. So he's saying this is an anti-nuclear site, and with the two moons of Mars, we're communicating back to Earth when we could see it and when it would matter, because they figured that we would get to the point of war and a nuclear weapon. And he's also confirming that the Rendlesham Forest incident, which was a UFO documented military case in outside of England, or Sussex County in England, regarding the 9.8 feet for each of the sides of the equilateral triangle of the probe that was made into a cast for 3 days. This also has measurements related to what's on Mars, and so he's working on that. I know it's a long stretch for what people are used to, but I just want to let people know about it in case you want to get the background at flybynews.com and look up the big surprise from the Cassini Earth flyby. It's been 18 years of working with him, and he's just one of a kind, so... I hope you check it out.
Okay, well, in closing out, Jonathan, how do people get to Flyby News? What's the URL?
Yeah, flybynews.com, FLYBYNEWS.com.
Okay, so thank you for the updates and the presentation, especially the part about Tony Rook, because I'm sure that will be something that we'll be wanting to pursue here on the teleconference in the near future. I think it's time for announcements. Does anybody have any? If you do, star six, and we'll put you right on.
Craig?
Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, this is, I haven't really looked into this particularly yet, but does everybody recall, or did anyone see news about Google changing their algorithms as a way of combating fake news? This is something I started to see this kind of late April, I think. And I even remember getting into a discussion with an official story supporter about why I found this to be very problematic, that you know, dissenting voices could be silenced because some algorithm would determine that that the story wasn't credible or the source wasn't credible. Well, I have noticed a dramatic effect on at least two of my articles that normally get very heavy traffic. One of them happens to be one called How We Know a Large Plane Didn't Hit the Pentagon. That one I wrote in like 2010, and I think it's been read by about 240,000 people up to now. And starting at the beginning of May, the numbers of daily visitors to that particular page dropped dramatically, like more than 50%, almost overnight. And I even noticed the same effect, not quite as dramatic, with the one I did, where the interview I did with William Pepper about his latest book about the Martin Luther King assassination. The daily hits I get on the blog are lower than I've seen them in several years, and I suspect this is playing a role. So I just wanted to point that out to people, and maybe other people might notice similar effects happening in other areas.
Okay, thank you for that. Wayne Costi.
Yeah, so my comment here is the United National Anti-War Conference is being held, I believe it's in Richmond, Virginia. I think it's the middle of this upcoming month. If you type in UNAC Anti-War Conference, you should find it. If people are willing and able to go to maybe table or to be there, that will be appreciated. I'm not aware of any organized effort yet, but I'm glad to support people who want to do that. I was at the 2015 or 14 one that was in Secaucus, New Jersey, and the other one that had been in Stamford, Connecticut a couple years before that. It's a good venue, a lot of support, except really from the leadership when they're in their official capacities. That's how it was. But that's Richmond, Virginia, middle of June. That's all. Thanks. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. Okay. Well, I'm going to take off the if I can find it here. I'll take off the. I guess I'm not. I wanted to give everybody a chance. Oh, here we go. Take it out of Q&A mode real quick. Anybody that had a problem with technical issues and wasn't able to make an announcement, wish to make one, say your name. We'll give you a chance. Go ahead. Okay. Well, then it sounds like everyone has had the opportunity, and so we thank you all for your cooperation tonight, and we look forward to seeing you the last Wednesday of June. Have a good week, a good month, everybody. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.